15. Let's start up again, please. Okay, so for our second session today, the topic is chemical constituents in e-liquids and aerosols. So this is a little bit longer session. We're going to go with four presentations, and then we'll take clarifying breaks and then a question, and then we'll have the final speakers. So let's start out with the first one is Dr. Trehe from the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. And all my time talking to you, I should have asked you if I pronounced it correctly.
Sure, that's good enough.
Okay.
Yep, thank you. The presentation today is a results of a monitoring study that was done in 2009 and 2010 on several companies that provided e-cigarettes and refills and cartridges. And, you know, I have no financial connections to any of the e-cigarette companies or their tobacco industry. This was done in conjunction with the Offices of Regulatory Affairs. They collected the samples, and then we did the analysis. I think we've seen this before, but at that time when this work was done, this is what a typical e-cigarette looked like. They were trying to resemble cigarettes. We've talked about the four major components that was before. There are acceptable methods for analysis for nicotine. Nicotine and tobacco products, that's been around for quite a while. They just have not been applied to e-cigarettes or their liquids. So they require some modification to be used directly, not directly transferable, but they're very quite similar. So typically gas chromatography for nicotine is used in solvents. HPLC with UV detection is well established. And HPLC mass spec can be used for trace components of interest, like the tobacco-specific nitrosamines. And NMR is a new technology, relatively new because they've got the high-resolution instruments now, which can be allowed to in a single analysis, get all the major components. Not suitable for trace components. We were requested to analyze not only for the nicotine, but for some of the other components of interest, and we were asked to do the five significant impurities that are often in nicotine: cottonine, anatidine, niosmin, anabasine, and beta-nicotiarin. So to do that, we had to make some modifications to the USP method. We were able to do that by selecting a column and a pH, which allowed all these components to be separated in one analysis. So before we started doing the monitoring, we demonstrated the method works. We got the linearity and the limit detection, limit quantitation, recoveries, and the percent relative standard deviation to demonstrate the methods were accurate. You know, I realized that from Dr. Watson's talk that there are some 450 or more products in the marketplace. We did not look at even a small fraction of that. We looked at just several. So there's a realization that this data may not be representative of the market as a whole, but does represent the data that we were able to obtain at that time on these products. And what we found was in this particular product, Smoking Everywhere, you can see that the values on the label don't necessarily match the results for the assay. And we think this was actually due to a packaging problem. They may have made them originally correct, but they were using a silicone stopper, and the stopper actually was acting like a sponge picking up the nicotine. So that may have been their problem. And we noticed later on that they had changed that because there was two phases. In 2010, they changed their packaging. So the labels values are not what we'd like them to be. Enjoy was another manufacturer, and again, the same problem. And you can see there's, even though there might be a trend for higher, that's not really accurate. 60 was another manufacturer, which was brought in greater concerns. You can see that there's three samples we analyzed that were told, specified not to contain nicotine, and two of them did. One of them at 20 mg in the sample. So that would be a significant issue for someone who was trying using nicotine. You'll also notice that some of the products which were supposed to contain nicotine did not. So it was an array of values from that supplier at that time. Now they may not be representative at this time, but when we analyzed, these are the results we obtained. Continue this. You can just kind of as a point of emphasis here. You can see that some manufacturers are doing a better job than others. You know, Johnson Creek. We're not showing any preference to anybody. Just illustrative that their values were plus or minus 10% of the label claim in this case, whereas the other manufacturer values are quite variable. I think it's also of interest that there are many flavors that I don't normally associate with cigarettes, simply strawberry, for example. And we'll talk later about Ramona Band and Cialis cigarettes. To try to kind of get in perspective on the data, these values were done in 2009 and 2010. But what does the data look like today? So we literature search. This is work from Barbara Davis and her team. And she shows that she's in her article, she says she did not find products that were labeled not to contain nicotine did not have nicotine in her sampling. So perhaps things have gotten better. You can see that though, some of the manufacturers, the values are quite variable. So it's some per mil could go all the way up to 34. So there are product qualities which the consumer would have difficulty identifying. To continue on this, we looked at the impurities as well, the miasma, nitazene, anabasine, beta-nicotinamide. Now, to put this in perspective, if we were to look at some of the nicotine control pharmaceutical products, they would typically have impurities, these impurities at less than quite a bit lower. But these products have impurities in the up to 4% or more of these nicotine-related impurities. And these health effects would need to be taken into account. We looked at and here is, you can see an example. We're showing the as I said before, there was a product packaging problem because the plug and 1.8 is just an extraction of the plug. So there's issues on the packaging which need to be resolved, which may already be resolved since we're looking at this in the rearview mirror. But at that time it was not acceptable, I would say. The number of flavors that are available, there's vanilla, you know, cherry. And this, if you go to a store today, which or recently I went visited one, the number of flavors is actually increased. You can almost get any flavor you would like, including cake, which is probably not a good choice. Refill solutions we also looked at. Again, it comes into flavors corresponding to the original packaging. We saw the same problems that we did before with some productly variable nicotine not following the label claims. This is also analyzed by LC and GC Mass Spec, but this one was HPLC, and you can see that the flavors and the impurity levels, and we see quite variable label percent declared. Again, this one here, some almost five times the label claim. We looked at propylene glycol is sometimes used as the solvent of choice. And according to USP guidance, if you have a pharmaceutical product using propylene glycol, the limit for diethylene glycol in that product is 0.1%. You can see we found one product, number 18, which had 0.4693%, 0.47%. So if it had been a pharmaceutical product, it would have been out of specification. How do our results compare with results reported more recently? We looked at some results from Etter et al. They looked at 10 manufacturers. And you can see there, they found a wide range of results as well. So the product quality is quite variable in the marketplace, and with some as high as or more than 4%, as we observed also. Tobacco-specific nitrosamines are of particular interest because they're often associated with possible carcinogenic activity. In our laboratory, we did not detect them at the time. Our limits of detections are shown here, Division of Pharmaceutical Analysis, DPA 2009. But it does not mean that they're not present. So I show the results for Kim and Shin in 2013, which show trace levels of these tobacco-specific nitrosamines, which would be of concern, might be. Additional concerns are other additives that are being or could be added to these products. See, you can, at the time we had, we purchased cartridges supposedly to contain E-Cialis. Cialis is tadalafil, but what we found, this was done with Michael Hedwiger, he found that the E-Cialis was really aminotadalafil, so it's a chemical analog, a designer drug, instead of the Cialis. We actually tried to test to see if it was released, and we did not detect it in the aerosol. So, but this technology is improving. Rimonabant was also cartridges are also available, and it was interesting about that. Rimonabant is not approved for use in the U.S. And the cartridges which were labeled not to contain nicotine did contain nicotine as well. So kind of an interesting situation. The conclusions, the label accuracy does not seem to be representative. So nicotine at that time content was frequently mislabeled. Nicotine present in products labeled as nicotine free remains a concern. Even though Davis did not find it, I'm not convinced that it's still not a problem in the marketplace. Marketing products identified to contain pharmaceutical products is an issue, especially since they are not approved. And later we're going to hear about product stability, which I think is a significant issue. Stories that this tobacco-related impurities and standards, but still present in variable suppliers. So we see a lot of, there is an opportunity for better products in the marketplace based on what we've observed. And I think we've addressed some of these other questions in the previous presentations and maybe later today. And you have to be concerned somewhat with the inhalation of solvents, long-term results, effects. So this work is compilation of a lot of people at the DPA who did most of the work. And we tried to reference the papers where people, we've described their work in this paper. There's a lot of good work going on and being published. So thank you very much.
Okay, our second presentation will be by Dr. Flora from the Altria Client Services, and he will be speaking on nicotine and related impurities in e-cigarette cartridges, stability studies, and methodology. Dr. Flora?
Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Jason Flora. I'm with Altria Client Services. Altria Client Services is an organization that supports the Altria Group and their companies. The work I'm going to talk about today was in support of the company Newmark. Newmark develops and markets the MarkTen e-cigarette. So again, the subject of what I'm going to talk about today is nicotine and related impurities in e-cigarette cartridges. I'm going to talk about some results from some stability studies, and I'm going to share a little bit of information on some methodologies. So I'll start with a little background. Most of you know that nicotine used in e-cigarette fluids is extracted from tobacco. And the purity of that nicotine really depends on how the extraction was done and the grade of the nicotine. For example, the MarkTen products, we use U.S. Pharmacopeia grade or USP grade nicotine. And the U.S. and the European Pharmacopeia make recommendations for the purity of nicotine that should be used in pharmaceutical products. There are also recommendations that are made in the International Conference for Harmonization, the ICH Guidelines in Purities in New Drug Products, Q3BR2. But there's really no official, or there has been no official purity recommendation for the nicotine used in e-cigarettes. And there's been some publications in the scientific literature. We just heard from Dr. Trahey as one, and some other speakers today are referenced below. And they have looked at nicotine-related impurities in e-cigarette fluids, but none have evaluated these fluids during long-term storage. So the objective of the work I want to talk about today was to investigate nicotine, water content, and the nicotine-related impurities in Newmark prototype e-cigarette cartridges during long-term storage. So for this work, we evaluated a variety of storage conditions. Two of them were taken from the ICH guidance for the industry, Q1AR2, which is stability testing for new drug substances and products. This is the long-term storage and the accelerated storage conditions. We also did two sort of worst case scenario conditions, one we called a desert condition, which was a high heat, low humidity condition, and then a jungle condition, which is a high heat, high humidity condition. So the work I'm going to talk about today was really two separate studies. The first study we used long-term conditions, desert and jungle, and a second study we used long-term and accelerated conditions. So for simplicity, the data that I'm going to share is from the first study, but all of the observations in the high temperature conditions were confirmed by the second study. I'm just not showing that data for simplicity. But in both studies, all samples were tested at a minimum of every 3 months, tested for nicotine, water content, specified nicotine impurities. So for the analytical methodologies we used, all of the e-cigarette cartridges were disassembled and placed in the glass vials. This included the gauze, the heater coil assembly, and the metal shell. So I'm showing on the table here the methodologies that we used. To measure nicotine, we used gas chromatography with flame ionization detector. For water, we used gas chromatography with a thermal conductivity detector. I'm not going to talk in detail about those methods. Those are pretty basic methods. I will, in some later slides, talk about some details for the method for the specified nicotine impurities. This was a liquid chromatography method with multi-stage mass spectrometry. All three methods were fully validated, consistent with ICH guidelines. Validation of analytical procedures. So let's talk about what we saw. So I'll start with nicotine. Showing here on the y-axis, if I can get the, nope, no pointer. Oh, there it is. So on the y-axis, I'm showing nicotine. This is percent initial concentration, so it's starting at 100%. And this is with respect to time under three storage conditions. And what we observed for these prototypes was that under the long-term conditions, if we consider the ambient conditions, we do see a loss of nicotine with respect to time. We saw about 25% loss. And before I go on, I wanted to clarify that each data point represents a triplicate triplicate measure. I'm showing one standard deviation with the error bars. The squares on the plot represents a product that had no flavor, and the diamond is a product that had flavor added to it. So in the jungle conditions, we also saw the loss of nicotine. Saw about 35% of the nicotine was lost after 12 months of storage. And under desert conditions, which is a higher temperature, this is 43 degrees Celsius, we saw about 70% of the nicotine lost over 12 months under these conditions. So we also looked at water. For the formulations we used, the water content under ambient conditions remained relatively stable, stayed within about 10% of its target concentration. But when we stored these in high relative humidity, or 85% relative humidity under the jungle conditions, we saw about a 70% increase in water. For the desert conditions, which is about 15% relative humidity, a very dry condition, we saw about 70% loss of the initial water concentration over 12 months. So now we'll talk about the specified nicotine impurities. These are the impurities that are listed in the European Pharmacopoeia, monograph 1452. It includes cotinine, nicotine anoxide, beta-nicotiamine, miosamine, nornicotine, enobasine, and anatidine. So there are, there are methods listed in the pharmacopoeia on how to measure nicotine-related impurities. But we wanted to have a more sensitive method, a more specific method, so we developed our own using liquid chromatography with multi-stage mass spectrometry. And it involves an extraction solution of 70-30 methanol water. We used deuterated internal standards shown in the table to the right. There were not deuterated internal standards available for all of the specified nicotine impurities, in which case we just used the closest diluters. Chromatography was done on a ultra-performance liquid chromatograph with a C18 X-bridge column. Mobile phase, this was a gradient run. Mobile phase was 10 millimolar ammonium acetate. And mobile phase B was Optima grade methanol. Again, it was collected on a triple quadruple mass spectrometer in the multiple reaction monitoring mode. So what do we see? For these specified nicotine impurities, only three were observed to increase with respect to time during this stability study. We saw an increase in nornicotine. I'm sorry, these are all plotted percent relative to the initial nicotine concentration. We saw an increase in nornicotine. We saw an increase in nicotine anoxide, as well as cotinine under long-term conditions for 12 months. But all of the specified impurities remained less than 0.5% of the total nicotine concentration during this long-term storage. But under high temperature conditions, we saw something interesting. Samantha mentioned earlier about using high temperatures to predict the outcome, or accelerated conditions to predict the outcome of long-term storage conditions. Well, we saw some interesting results with that. What I'm showing here is this is an example for nicotine and oxide. We saw the same thing for nornicotine and cotinine. It's the same data for the long-term condition, so you see a steady increase showing percent the nicotine oxide relative to the initial nicotine concentration. But under the desert conditions and the jungle conditions, we saw it increase and then drop off. So what's occurring is you're having a concurrent formation of the impurity or the degradation product, and also evaporation. So when the rate of formation is faster than the rate of evaporation, the levels increase, and when the rate of evaporation exceeds that of the rate of formation, the levels decrease. So using these for predictive measures, or using accelerated or high temperature conditions for predictive measures for these analytes, I do not believe would work in this category. So in summary, for the prototypes in this study, nicotine loss is observed during shelf life, and it's dependent on storage condition. These disposable cartridges can lose or gain water, and of course that depends on storage conditions. We gain water under high humidity, lose water under low humidity. All specified nicotine impurities remain below 0.5% of the total nicotine concentration after 12 months under long-term conditions, and this is below the identification and qualification thresholds proposed by the ICH guidelines in impurities in new drug products. And again, high temperatures can promote the loss of specified impurities during stability studies. So you're seeing the evaporation of these volatile compounds, making it difficult to use accelerated conditions as a predictive model for long-term conditions. Thank you.
Just a reminder, if you have questions, please write them out, pass them to the volunteers on the side, and we'll pick those up as we go into the question period. Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Gonowitz from Roswell Park Cancer Institute, speaking on toxicants and e-cigarette refill solutions and vapor. Shay? Backward, Anna. Hopefully
okay.
There's a mouse.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak here. This is my disclosure of a potential conflict of interest. I received a grant award on nicotine dependence research, and this award was sponsored by one of a pharmaceutical company which is manufacturer of a smoking cessation medication. But this award was not paid to me directly. It was paid to my employer, and research was completed in 2013. And I have no financial relationship with any manufacturers, distributors, or retailers of electronic cigarettes or tobacco industry. So I was asked to talk about the toxicants and potential hazards, chemical hazards in electronic cigarettes. So the first question would be how we can classify it. What are the toxicants? What should we look for? And there are some lists of the chemicals that are considered as a toxics, and there are different agencies, different approaches to classify chemicals as a toxic, as a potentially dangerous for humans. So we've got, for example, an Environmental Protection Agency that is looking at classifying the different chemicals in the air, in the environment, that might pose the hazards to everyone. And there are agencies looking at the carcinogenic hazards. So what is the risk of developing cancer when being exposed to certain chemicals? We've got national toxicology programs. We've got some classification based on the risk in the work environment, and there are thresholds, there are limits for chemicals in the workplaces. And we've got, for the regulatory purposes, we've got also the limits for the different toxins in drug products, or we've got actually the list of the potentially harmful constituents, which was developed for the purposes of regulating tobacco products. So we can look what is on this list, and if there is something on this list, we can consider this toxicant, and if we find this compound in an electronic cigarette product, we may claim that the electronic cigarette products contain toxicants. We can do opposite thing. We can look what is classified as a safe chemical. And actually most of, the many manufacturers of electronic cigarettes claim that they contain products that are classified as a generally recognized as safe or GRAS. And there is an important limitation for this classification because it was developed for the food industry. So based on the law, based on the definition of the GRAS class, this indication is it applies only to food. And it brings a lot of controversies and some questions. So this is the case of acetaldehyde, that if you look at the GRAS classification, you will find this product on the list. So it is considered to be safe. But if you look at the data from the inhalation studies and some evaluation of a carcinogenic risk, actually this the same compound is on the list and is considered as a probably or possible human carcinogen. So it's not always the clear what we classified as a toxicant. And there is a nice review showing different methods to look at the toxicants and the different chemicals in electronic cigarette products that was recently published. And as you can see, most of the methods use the hyphenated approaches with the gas chromatography or liquid chromatography to separate compounds and then mass spectrometry or other detection techniques to detect and measure the concentration of the toxicants. For heavy metals, there are the coupled plasma mass spectrometry. I will not talk about it because this will be the subject of the separate talk later. What is important, these are quite sophisticated and very sensitive methods, so they allow us to detect even the very small amounts of the potential toxicants in the product. I would like to organize my talk by talking not just that give the brief list of the toxicants that were found in a electronic cigarette, but what might be the sources of the toxicants. So the toxicants might be present in the product, and in this category we might get a toxicants which are impurities in solvents. They might be impurities in nicotine, as it was mentioned before. The flavors might be considered as a toxic compound. They might be impurities, the toxic impurities in flavor extracts or additives used in electronic cigarettes. There might be some contaminants from manufacturing process that are introduced when the product is manufactured. There might be contaminants from storage containers. There might be degradation byproducts they were mentioned before, and substances introduced by the retailers. And the other source of the toxicants in electronic cigarettes these toxicants may be actually generated when the product is used. And these might be byproducts of thermal degradation, degradation by products generating during storage, impurities from storage, and substances introduced by users. So first, let's come back to the impurities in a solvent used to dissolve nicotine. And I want to clarify that because there was some misleading information in the media. There are few compounds, and the name might sound similar, but they are not the same thing. So we've got the propylene glycol, which is one of the most common solvent used in electronic cigarette, and we've got ethylene glycol, which is considered to be toxic. We've got diethylene glycol, which is highly toxic. And we also got polyethylene glycol, which is used in some of the electronic cigarettes. And these are not the same product, the same chemicals, and they have a different classification. They are not all toxic. So diethylene glycol and ethylene glycol are toxic. And the ethylene glycol, the one study that was mentioned here before, found some traces of the ethylene glycol in the products. And also the most recent study done in Germany looking at the products available in the European market also found the ethylene glycol, the other toxic glycol, in some products. And there was actually one manufacturer that all the products contain high levels of ethylene glycol. And it was suspected that this manufacturer substituted propylene glycol with the toxic solvent for nicotine. So these impurities, these toxicants might be introduced, might be present in the solvents for nicotine. There might be some impurities that are associated with nicotine, because nicotine is extracted from tobacco. So whatever is in the plant might come to the nicotine solution, and this is the summary of the early testing of electronic cigarette products that found traces of nitrosamines in the cartridges and in the liquids. And as you can see, the levels of this nitrosamines are significantly lower that found in different tobacco products, including smokeless tobacco. And they are very similar to the levels found in some of the actually the products that we consider the safest products, the nicotine replacement therapy products. And the other source of nitrosamines might be the tobacco flavor that is added in electronic cigarette. But this summary showed that it's also related with the nicotine per se, because in, as you can see, these impurities were found in the nicotine replacement therapies where we don't have the tobacco flavor there. What about the flavors and some additives in liquids and in the products? So this is the study done by Frostolinos, and they report the presence of the diacetide and acetylpropionyl, which is the flavor used in electronic cigarettes. And it is approved and safe when ingested, so it is on the list. It has a GRAS classification. But when you look at the toxicological assessment of these compounds for the inhalation, then this compound should be classified as a toxicant. And actually, it is responsible for respiratory dysfunction and some diseases in bronchitis. So both compounds were found in the majority of the tested liquid, and the similar concentration were found in the liquid in aerosol, which suggests that these impurities are present in the product. They are not generated during the product use. So this main source of this impurity might be the product itself. This is the new study that we just completed in the similar flavor. This is the benzaldehyde, which is considered to be safe in a food product, but there are some toxicological data showing that inhalation of benzaldehyde might be harmful. And when we look on over 100 different products, we found that majority of the products contain this compound. And what was significant, the significant higher levels were found in the product with the cherry flavor. And actually, benzaldehyde is responsible for this effect. But it's not only, when we're talking about the flavors and potentially toxicity of the flavors, sometimes it's not just the one compound, it's not just the one chemical that is responsible. So we might challenge the problem with the mixture of the chemicals that are responsible for the flavors. And this is the case of the cinnamon flavor in the two studies that identified four different chemicals responsible for the cytotoxic effect in these products. What about the vapor, aerosol generated from electronic cigarettes? I'm using the term that is used by the users, but we are talking about the aerosol. So we did the study of the smoking machine, and we generated the aerosol, and we looked what's there. We did not find many of the toxicants there that are present in the tobacco smoke, but we found some toxicants like carbonic compounds, the formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, and acrolein. We found a toluene in some of the products, which is the organic solvent. We found the traces of nitrosamines and some heavy metals. What you can see here in this table is also that the levels are significantly lower than in the tobacco products, in tobacco smoke. But the other important finding was that the range of this toxicant in aerosol is quite significant. So we've got some products that contain very low levels of the toxicants, and we also had the products with the higher levels of toxicants. So what might be the sources? What might be the reason for these differences in the toxicant level in the vapor? So, of course, if they are in a product, this will be the manufacturing process anything that is made with the product during the manufacturing process. But if some compounds are generated during the use, when the liquid is heated, then we are losing the possibility to control for these factors. And this actually is probably the case with the carbonyl compounds. So we found acrolein with formaldehyde and acetaldehyde, and actually the other researchers also confirm these findings. And there is an explanation that when the glycerol and propylene glycol, the two most common solvents for nicotine in electronic cigarettes, are heated and there is access to the air, they can be oxidized, and the toxic compounds can be generated. And this is the study that was published recently, actually showing, I think this is the strong evidence that this is the case. So what they did, they took a few products, a few liquids, and they measured the presence of the carbonyls in the raw product, and then they incubated the product, they heated the product in a quite moderate temperature, like 150 centigrade. We know this is somewhere in the range that might be inside of the electronic cigarette. And what you can see here, when the product was heated, the amount of the formaldehyde and acetaldehyde, two toxicants, were increased. So these studies suggested that this compound can be generated when the solvent, the nicotine solvent, is heated. And this study, it was mentioned before, we did this study that actually showed that when you increase the battery output voltage, which resulted in an increasing temperature in the product, we increase the likelihood of generating the toxicants and the degradation products. I know that there will be a separate talk of the packaging, but I want to talk shortly about the packaging in the context of the toxicity of the product. So the other source of the toxicants might be the packaging of these products. So when we consider the toxicity assessment of electronic cigarette, we need to look at the safety of the packaging too. So the packaging itself, we have to make sure that the packaging itself does not have any adverse effect on the product through some chemicals interaction with the product or leaching of packaging material or absorption. And the proper packaging should protect and should minimize the risk of generating some toxicants. And just to summarize my talk, so looking at this potential source that we found and the other researchers identified the sources of the toxicants in the product. So what might be the potential strategies to minimize the risk? So we know that the risk is negligible when comparing to tobacco smoke, but if there is any risk and if there are possibility to reduce the risk, why not to implement a proper strategy to minimize the risk to protect consumers? So if we are looking in the impurities in solvents, the ethylene glycol, if we have some kind of standards for solvents used in a manufacturing process, then we can reduce the risk of the toxicants that comes from the solvent. What about the impurity of nicotine? There might be some standards for the nicotine that should be of the proper purity. The presence of the organic toxicants should not be there. For example, the toluene that we detected, we think that it comes from the nicotine solution. That actually there are nicotine extracts on the market that the nicotine is dissolved in the toluene. And this might indicate the source of this toxicant. What about the flavors and additives? I think that the key point here is the testing for the inhalation toxicity for the flavorings. Disclosing and looking for some approval of some flavors that actually are on the grass list, but might be dangerous when inhaled, as it might be necessary here. What about the contaminants, the toxicants that are introduced in the manufacturing process? The good manufacturing policy practice to avoid any contamination with potentially dangerous compounds might be implemented. Contaminants for storage containers, inert, airtight, and light resistant containers. We've heard about the degradation products from nicotine. So this type of standard should minimize the risk from this source. The degradation byproducts, the proper labeling, the storage indication for the users, the safe packaging, and again, maybe the standards for the packaging. What about the substances that are introduced by retailers? It may happen if someone modified the product. So maybe some kind of seal packaging, seal bottles can be required. the byproducts of thermal degradation. I think this is very challenging problem, and we had this discussion about the effect of the temperature on the nicotine delivery. So it seems like this is very important factor that affects the nicotine delivery. But on the other hand, it seems to be also very important factor that might affect the toxicity of the product. So where is the balance between the product that is effective in nicotine delivery, but is also as safe as possible, and the levels of toxicants are not elevated? The substances introduced by users probably tightly close containers and bottles, and this might be required. Thank you so much.
Okay, our next speaker is Monique Williams from the University of California, Riverside, speaking on metals and salicylates identified in e-liquids and aerosols. Forward, backward, and the pointer.
Okay, thank you for that lovely introduction. Okay, so before I begin, I just want to go ahead and say that there are no conflicts of interest with my research, and my work as well as our lab's work has been funded by TRDRP as well as NIH. So this is an outline of the talk that I'm going to give today, and I'm going to go over the metal components found in electronic cigarettes, and then I'll talk about the metals and the fluid as well as the aerosol, and then I'll kind of discuss a few caveats with actually evaluating the elements present in these devices, and then I'll wrap up with some summaries and some future considerations. So as we've heard many times today, electronic cigarettes have two major components that I'm going to focus on. You have the pointer, the battery, and then you have the cartomizer, which has included the atomizing unit and the cartridge fluid into a single unit. And as we know, these devices are composed of metal components. And so in the study that I'm going to talk about, we wanted to test the hypothesis that the metals in these electronic cigarettes can be incorporated into the fluid as well as the aerosol, which is unlike conventional cigarettes. And we tested this using a popular brand of e-cigarette. So the way we started the study is cartomizers were dissected, and then they were visualized using a dissecting microscope. And then the morphology of the components were analyzed using scanning electron microscope as well as transmission electron microscopy. And the elemental analysis was done using energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy. Now, upon analysis of the aerosol, we use inductively coupled plasma optical emission spectroscopy. So to understand the actual anatomy of the cartomizers, we performed these dissections. And what we found is they have three major parts. They had the outer mouthpiece, then they had the atomizing unit, which consisted of the air tube, wires, and a wick as well. And then there were two fiber types. There was an inner mesh of fibers, and then there was this outer polyfill. And both fiber types were saturated with the cartomizer fluid. And all dissected cartomizers that we saw actually showed evidence of use prior to packaging. For example, there were burn marks on the fibers as well as electrophoretic movement of the fluid. So the first component of the cartomizer I'm going to talk about is actually the wires. So there are two wires. You have the thick wire, which is here, and we did elemental analysis of it, and this is showing micrographs of the surface of the wire, and we found that it was mainly copper coated with silver. The other wire is the thin filament that wrapped around the actual wick, and we found that that was comprised mainly of chromium and nickel, or nichrome. So the wires were joined together using solder. And most solder joints in the dissected cartomizers were actually of poor quality, and they looked very much like this image here. And they looked very friable. And when we did elemental analysis of the solder, we found that it was comprised mainly of tin with no traces of lead. And that makes sense because the use of lead in solder has been banned in China. And we think it's this lack of lead that has resulted in the solder joints being very friable. So there are a couple other components that are present in the cartomizers such as the WIC, which was comprised mainly of silica and calcium, which are characteristics of fiberglass. Then there were also the fibers, and the fibers were actually composed of an organic tin particles. And then we actually looked at the mouthpiece as well, which was comprised of iron, chromium, and manganese, which is characteristics of stainless steel. And then we also looked at the air tube, which was comprised mainly of nickel. So the next component of the carnomizer I'm going to talk about is actually the carnomizer fluid. And in order to do this, we actually had to separate it from the fibers. So what we did is we took both fiber types, we put them in spin columns, and then we isolated the fluid from the actual fibers. So then we did actual elemental analysis of the fluid, and we found that there were tin particles as well as tin whiskers present in the actual fluid. Now, when we did do this isolation of the fluid, there were these large pellets that had actually formed that were visible with the naked eye. And so when we actually looked at them, both the white pellet as well as the black, we found that they too were comprised mainly of tin. So our lab was very interested in knowing the effects of this carnomizer fluid on cell growth. So using human pulmonary fibroblasts, we took the fluid as well as particles from the pellet, and we tested them on human pulmonary fibroblasts using two different concentrations. And what we found is that the high concentration with cell growth was actually inhibited with the fluid with the particles. So then what we did is we took the fluid and we centrifuged it to eliminate the particles in the fluid, and we retested it. And what we found is that cell growth was actually recovered upon removal of the particles. And these results were, And we found that the results were also very similar when we looked at cell attachment. So the actual cytotoxicity of the fluid with the particles was due to the particles, and once the particles were removed, cell growth was actually recovered. So now that we know that there are metal particles that were present in the fluid as well as different parts of the carnomizer, we wanted to know if these metal particles were actually getting into the aerosol. So what we did is we generated aerosol using the lowest airflow rate to produce a considerable puff. And so what I'm showing here is a comparison of the abundance of particles that are present in both room air as well as in the aerosol. And what I'm showing here is that the aerosol actually contained relatively large particles that were approximately within the range of 1 to 30 microns. So doing elemental analysis of the aerosol, we also found that there were tin particles as well as silicate beads, nickel, and silver particles that all range from about 500 nanometers to about 10 microns. And this could explain why some users have reported having a metallic taste in their mouth upon using these devices. Now, one thing we did notice when we were actually doing the analysis is that some particles, especially silver, was actually an agglomerate of smaller particles. So knowing this information, we were interested in counting the number of particles present. So we collaborated with the Air Pollution Research Center at UCR, and we actually did count the number of particles that were present in the aerosol. And what we found is in one puff, it contained numerous particles, numerous nanoparticles that were less than 100 nanometers. So now that we know that there were nanoparticles present in the aerosol, we wanted to see if we could identify any metal particles. So we went to the transmission electron microscope, and using X-ray microanalysis, we were actually able to identify chromium, nickel, as well as tin nanoparticles. And they were all surrounded by this organic material that we believe is the humectant. And nanoparticles are really important because they could potentially penetrate deeply into the airways and then produce possible toxic effects. So before I showed all the different particles, metals that were present in the aerosol, but we also wanted to know what other metals were elements were present. So what I'm showing here is a list of 29 elements that have been reported in the aerosol to date. And 7 of these elements, the ones in bold, were actually on the FDA's harmful and potentially harmful substance list. So it's important that we wanted to compare the concentrations found in the aerosol to that of conventional cigarette smoke. So we used the mainstream smoke from a popular brand, and we found that these 18 elements here were present in higher concentrations in aerosol versus conventional cigarette smoke, whereas these 5 here were found in equal concentrations to cigarette smoke, whereas these five elements were present in lower concentrations than in cigarette smoke. So this is showing that most elements present were in higher concentrations than cigarette smoke. So then, if we just look at the elements that were in higher concentration and we arrange them in a hierarchy, we found that sodium was the highest concentration with 4.18 micrograms per 10 pops, whereas thallium was found in 0.0004 micrograms per 10 pops. So the concentrations of the elements present in the aerosol will vary. But the elements present in the aerosol will vary also by product. So I'll use tin as an example since I've talked about it for most of my talk. And in brand A, this is the concentration that was reported in tin puffs. Well, if a consumer were to take 200 puffs a day, they could be exposed to 0.72 micrograms per day. But if they were to switch to another brand, for example, brand B, which I have not talked about, they could be exposed to 88.2 micrograms per day. Whereas if they smoke conventional cigarettes, tin is actually not detected in the smoke. So the exposure to a certain element will vary by. It's an interesting note that the average daily intake of tin via inhalation is 3 micrograms per day. So depending on which brand a consumer is using, they could either be exposed to more or less than the average daily intake. An inhalation of tin could potentially lead to respiratory irritation. So now I'm going to talk about a few caveats with interpreting this metal concentrations in the aerosol. And the first one is that there is no standard for generating aerosol. The data that I presented here was using the lowest airflow rate to produce an actual puff, but consumers are smoking them much differently. In addition, aerosols are complex mixtures. They contain elements, they contain metals, they contain organic compounds, and most government safety standards are, you know, developed for a single element or a single metal. In addition, e-cigarette aerosols contain metal nanoparticles, which could be more harmful than the larger particles present. And these nanoparticles do contribute considerably less to the actual mass that's measured. And lastly, the metal concentrations in the aerosols that'll be something that needs to actually be addressed as well. So in summary, electronic cigarettes contain metal components, and these metals can actually get into the fluid as well as in the aerosol. The solder joints lacking lead were friable, result in the tin being distributed throughout the cartomizer as well as into the aerosol. Metal particles as well as metal nanoparticles were present in the aerosol. And metal particles inhibited cell growth in human pulmonary fibroblasts, and upon removal of the particles, that effect actually decreased. And lastly, the concentrations of most elements detected in the aerosol were in higher concentrations than cigarette smoke. So some future considerations are, the data that I showed today show that there are some quality control concerns with their manufacturing, such as the solder joints being friable and, you know, melting and being distributed throughout the cartomizer. In addition, the gentlest puffing conditions were used. But as I mentioned, consumers are smoking these much differently, and our lab is actually currently testing the metal concentrations found in puffing conditions based on our recent topography data to actually mimic an actual user. Further quantification of an analysis of metal nanoparticles will be important because we're not really sure what the full effects of inhaling these particles could lead to. And even though I show the data for one particular brand, we have recently looked at other brands and other models, and we have found that these devices also expose metal elements in the aerosol. And lastly, the health effects of inhaling metal nanoparticles as well as these complex mixtures are not known. And so future studies will have to address these concerns. So with that, I would like to thank my PA, Dr. Prue Talbot, my collaborators with the metal analysis, Dr. Krasimir Boselhoff, as well as Woody Smith, collaborators with the cytotoxicity testing, Dr. Sabrina Lin, and the collaborators with the particle counting, Dr. Paul Zeman and Dr. Aiko Matsunaga, my team, Amanda Villarreal and Michael Dang, as well as the rest of the Talbot lab. I would also like to thank TRC. our environmental toxicology program for their funding, and then I definitely want to thank the FDA and the CGP for this opportunity for allowing me to come and speak today. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take some clarifying questions. Let me see if I can gather some cards. Any clarifying questions? Jeannie? No? Coming up? No? Dr. Flora, thank you. Were cartridge contents protected from lights? And actually, I am going to use my Oprah Winfrey. These are just clarifying questions. We'll do the panel the way we did it before. So, cartridges contents protected from light.
They were in. These were prototype samples, but they were stored in polypropylene tubes with polyethylene end caps, and they actually had silicone caps on these prototypes. Chambers are prevent light exposure.
Okay. I'm saving some of the questions for the regular panel, okay? So it's not that I'm dissing your question. I'm just trying to make sure they're as clarifying as possible. Was the product packaging representative of how the product would be stored in retail? You nodded your head. So packaging as in retail.
At the time that the study was began, yes, the packaging has since evolved. So similar.
Okay. A question that I think Dr. Hayes, do nicotine replacement products contain any toxins?
It's a kind of a wide open question there. It's just, you know, what's a toxin? It's just a matter of the dose. So we did see the diethylene glycol exceeded the USP guidelines for DEG and propylene glycol. So that we would consider that out of spec.
So there could be toxins, but out of spec. Okay. I'm going to save that. You know, it's hard when the questions are really long that they're clarifying. I'm going to save that one too. Okay, so I have several questions for the panel discussion that will come back, and I said because, as you may have noticed in your program, not all of the speakers are going to be the same in the panel, so we'll do a bit of the Oprah Winfrey technique, okay? All right, so let's go back to the presentations. And the next speaker is Dr. Tom Eisenberg is going to be speaking on e-cigarette nicotine yield measurements, prediction, and regulation. Karen will get it going for you.
Well, thank you, FDA, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I guess I'll say before we get started that we'll wait 5 minutes.
Yeah, more questions, so hold on. Okay, let's go
for more questions. That one is just a panel discussion. Any research on reuse of ends as a delivery device for other substances such as marijuana? So is there any research on the reuse of ends as a delivery device for other substances such as marijuana? Nobody touched on that in their presentation. Do you want to? Any?
There hasn't been any research per se about the use of things like marijuana in these devices, but there are devices that can actually deliver THC, which is the major component of marijuana, in these devices. So there's electronic weed smokers, I guess.
Okay, thank you. How about this? Any risk of sensitivity, allergic reactions to the metal components of e-cigarettes?
There has been some reports that consumers or users that use these products do have allergic reactions to these devices. And there was a study that came out last year that actually talked about the health effects reported by actual consumers. And a lot of them are respiratory irritation. So it'll be coughing, chest pains, things like that associated with their use.
Okay, I'm going to ask a little non-panel question, or non-clarifying perhaps. Should a comparison study be conducted for e-cigarette toxicants and combusted, non-combusted tobacco products? So should a comparison study be conducted for e-cigarette toxicants and combusted, non-combusted tobacco products? I see a nodding head, but sir, you weren't one of the speakers yet. I'm not seeing the speakers. Michelle.
Yeah, I think what we see right now from the population data, the most of the current e-cig users are ex-smokers. So this is the competitor for tobacco cigarettes. I haven't seen any data what the prevalence of the smokeless tobacco users who switch, who progress to electronic cigarettes. And of course, this is the product for inhalation. And we should look when talking about that. I did not mention any assessment of the risk in my study. I just focused what was detected because I know there will be separate session today looking at the toxicological assessment and the risk assessment. And I think we should look at the inhalation risk, not ingestion, not chewing. I haven't heard about a user who is chewing electronic cigarette. So I think that our natural comparator here, and still the most prevalent product, is a tobacco cigarette. So it seems like this would be the better, I think, comparator when we try to assess the reduction in the risk. There would be tobacco cigarettes.
Okay, thank you. Tom, your slide's ready. So do that again. Dr. Tom Eisenberg speaking.
Okay, thanks again. It's like Groundhog Day. Before I begin, I do want to say that for those of you who know me, you'll recognize the work I'm going to be presenting is that of Dr. Alan Shehadeh at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the American University of Beirut. Neither Dr. Shehadeh nor I have any conflicts of interest to report, though our work is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the Center for the Tobacco Products of the U.S. FDA. Anything I say does not reflect their views. I know a lot of you are multitasking, so I thought while I had your attention at the beginning, I'd tell you what the conclusions are. E-cigarettes are a set of devices that vary considerably across engineering and operating characteristics. When these characteristics interact with user behavior, together they influence the amount of nicotine emitted from the mouth end of an e-cigarette. The influence of device and behavior on nicotine yield can be measured, but more importantly, it can be predicted. And learning about e-cigarettes and crafting science-based regulation for them will require a programmatic approach that will involve understanding device characteristics, user behavior, and the interaction between the two. So if you agree with that, or if you don't care how we got there, you can go back to checking your email. But for the rest of you, I'll start with this, which is one of those often seen slides that describes supposedly what an e-cigarette is. I like slides like this because they're so gloriously imprecise. So for instance here, it's not true that all e-cigarettes have LED lights that light up when the smoker draws on them. It's not true that they all have batteries. They don't all have microprocessors. They do all have heaters, but it doesn't always vaporize nicotine. Some of them have cartridges. Not all those cartridges hold nicotine, nor do they all hold propylene glycol. There's often not a sensor that detects when the smoker takes a drag. There's an aerosol mist, not smoke without fire. And that if you suck on them, you may get a cloud of something, but it may not carry nicotine, and it could indeed carry some of the toxic byproducts of burning tobacco. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, this is an accurate slide. So here's a perhaps a better depiction of what e-cigarettes look like today, though not likely what they're going to look like tomorrow. Some of them do look like cigarettes. Some of them look like pipes. Some of them look like cigars. Some of them look more like flashlights. Here's one that doesn't have a battery, but it's powered directly by the USB. Here's one that you've seen before today, a tank system. This one allows you to adjust the voltage, as does this one, and you can see some of them have different size batteries. So the devices themselves are quite different. So are the liquids, as you've heard, and so I don't need to dwell too much on that, except to say that the vehicle is often propylene glycol or vegetable glycerin or a mixture of the two in various ratios. You've heard about the flavors. There's any number of flavors. I can't imagine listing them all for you. Some of my favorites by their description are Tutti Frutti and cotton candy. The nicotine levels range from zero, that is in these flavors, the nicotine levels range from zero to around 36 milligrams per milliliter. I have seen higher for the do-it-yourselfer who wants to mix their flavors at home, then they can buy 100 milligram per milliliter liquid. And then there's a variety of other additives in the liquid. If you're wondering what could influence the nicotine yield and other characteristics of the aerosol, here's some ideas of the things that might do that. Factors like the basic design: does it use a cartomizer, a tank? Do you drip the liquid directly on the heater? Is it a disposable or a rechargeable? The heating element, of course, is critical. The electrical resistance, the battery voltage flowing into it, the surface area, and the number of coils in the heating element are all critical. The liquid, as you might imagine, the nicotine concentration and what's used. What else is used in the liquid could influence what comes out of the aerosol, what comes out of the e-cigarette in the form of an aerosol. And then, of course, the user behavior, puff duration, inter-puff interval, number of puffs, generally what we measure and call puff topography. All of these things could influence what I've been asked to talk about today, which is nicotine yield. So to summarize for me, electronic cigarettes are an evolving product category in which an electrical heater is used to vaporize a liquid that often contains nicotine in order to produce an inhalable aerosol mist. E-cigarettes allow users to select from a myriad of combinations of designs, power input, and liquid composition, and probably provide consumers with an unprecedented degree of control over nicotine self-administration. And this control over nicotine self-administration has some profound positive and negative implications for individual and public health. Now, what I was asked to talk about was e-cigarettes and nicotine yield. I'll just define the term very quickly. Nicotine yield is the amount of nicotine that exits the mouth end of the e-cigarette. And we've been able to demonstrate that when measured appropriately, that is in a way that mimics exactly the user behavior, nicotine yield can indeed predict nicotine delivery to the user, at least for some tobacco products. It's certainly been long known that analytical laboratory studies of nicotine yield can elucidate key factors that influence it. And that's what I'm going to describe to you today with regard to electronic cigarettes. So what key factors might influence electronic cigarette nicotine yield? Certainly, liquid nicotine concentration is one. You've already heard about device power, the battery voltage, and its interaction with the heater resistance, and then the puffing behavior of the user. I'm just going to very quickly go over some data that are already published and available to you that describe how these factors might influence e-cigarette nicotine yield. The first has to do with liquid nicotine concentration and its influence on nicotine yield. We got our hands on two different concentration of nicotine liquid. Interestingly, one of them was labeled as 36 milligram per milliliter, the other labeled as 18. When we analyzed them, the 36 was actually closer to 16 and the 18 closer to 8. But in any case, they differ in the liquid nicotine concentration. And we programmed a machine to take some puffs, in the case here, 4-second puffs from a 3.3-volt device, and those puffs were of 17 milliliters per second puff velocity. And as you can see, the higher concentration led to a higher nicotine yield. No big surprise. The same thing could be said when you take a much longer puff, 8 seconds, which is about the longest we've seen reliably from experienced e-cigarette users, from a 5.6-volt device, again with a 17 milliliter per second puff velocity. Again, you see an increase in nicotine yield with the higher nicotine concentration liquid. These look like vastly different increases, but in fact they're not. This is about 1.4 times more from the higher concentration. This is about 1.6 times more from the higher concentration. So they're about the same. It's just some of the other parameters vary considerably. So what about those other parameters? Two of them are the power and the puff duration. And so here I'm manipulating both of those. First you see 2-second puffs, 4-second puffs, and 8-second puffs. And regardless of the voltage of the power supply, longer puffs lead to greater nicotine yield. But when you start looking at the power supply, that you see that more power within each puff duration leads to greater nicotine yield. So both puff duration and voltage seem to influence nicotine yield. Now, these were puffs of 33 milliliters per second duration. You see that here from the 8.5 milligram per milliliter liquid. You might wonder, well, what about puff velocity? Does that influence nicotine yield? Well, in fact, it doesn't. So here you see 17 milliliter per second puffs from 3.3 volt or 5.2 volt powered devices, 8 second puffs, 8.5 milligram per milliliter liquid, and on this side 33 milliliters per second, so a much faster puff. And you see almost identical nicotine yields from these vastly different speeds of puff velocity. And so you might wonder, well, how can that be? I mean, if the air is moving faster, then it's going to be picking up more nicotine, so there should be more nicotine coming out of the mouth end of the e-cigarette. That would be true if all things were equal, but in this case, all things aren't equal. The faster flow could indeed carry more nicotine, but it also cools the heating element as it passes by, such that there's less nicotine to carry. So when you have a slow puff, you get a lot of nicotine available, and you carry it all through. When you have a fast puff, you have much less nicotine available, and those two effects kind of cancel each other out, so that flow rate doesn't seem to make any difference when it comes to nicotine yield. Taken together, these data may explain why it is that e-cigarette users take larger and longer puffs. So you see the puff duration here, about 4 seconds compared to a tobacco cigarette smoker's 1.4 seconds. They're taking longer puffs, perhaps because they want to get more nicotine out of the device. Doesn't really explain why they use a lower flow rate, slower puffs. We hypothesize that that's simply because they've learned they don't have to expend the effort to take a faster puff. So why bother doing it? You simply learn to take a slower puff because it doesn't make any difference whether you go fast or slow. In fact, we tested a wide variety of electronic cigarettes under a wide variety of nicotine liquid conditions, voltages, puff durations, and you see some of the data in nicotine yield summarized for you here. What I think the biggest message you can take from this slide is that nicotine yield varies widely and sometimes is dramatically higher than you might expect from a combustible cigarette under similar conditions. It gets kind of tedious to test all these different devices, and in fact, I wouldn't recommend that's what we do. And so Dr. Shahadeh and his team have been working to develop a mathematical model to predict how much nicotine is emitted during e-cigarette use, so you don't have to undergo all, or you don't have to go through all of this testing. The model accounts for the time it takes for the coil to heat up after electricity begins flowing, and how much the coil cools back down between puffs. It also accounts for the various ways that heat can be transported away from the coil, by the air passing over it, by the latent heat of the liquid as it evaporates, by conduction through the metal solder to the body of the cartomizer, and by radiation to the surroundings. Key assumptions in the model are that the liquid follows ideal solution behavior, and that the heat and mass transfer processes are well described by boundary layer theory. Inputs to the model include puff velocity and duration, interpuff interval, the length, diameter, electrical resistance, and thermal capacitance of the heater coil, the thermodynamic properties of the liquid, and the concentration of nicotine and the ambient temperature of the air. Because the system of differential equations described by the model cannot be solved analytically, a computer code was developed to solve them numerically using a finite time-stepping algorithm. So let's see what we get. As it turns out, the predicted nicotine yield captures eloquently the measured nicotine yield. So we have an R-squared of 0.97, which in a psychologist's hands is outstanding. It does turn out that the predicted yield underpredicts the actual yield by a factor of about 2, and we think that's because of some of the assumptions about the thermodynamic processes. We're working to refine the model, and we expect it's going to get better over time. What we would suggest is that it's a model exactly like this one that could be used to aid regulation of nicotine yield and predict prior to any device coming to market how much nicotine is going to be emitted from its mouth end. In fact, speaking about regulation, some of the data I've shown you already speak to issues around the European Union's recent directive in April 2014 about limiting the maximum nicotine concentration to 20 nanograms per ml. According to that directive, that upper limit allows for a delivery of nicotine that is comparable to the permitted dose of nicotine derived from a standard cigarette. So let's explore that. We haven't tested 20 milligram per milliliter liquid directly, but we have tested 18. And so you see this is the same chart I showed you just a moment ago. And here with the arrows, you can see that in many cases, the directive seems to work well in terms of limiting the yield to that derived from a standard tobacco cigarette. In some cases, in fact, you get lower nicotine yields with an 18 milligram liquid. And interestingly, In several cases, you get dramatically higher nicotine yields with an 18 milligram per milliliter liquid that is higher than you would get from a standard cigarette. And we think this shows the futility of using a single factor to try to regulate something like nicotine yield, which in fact for an electronic cigarette is controlled by many interacting factors. So let's talk about regulating e-cigarette nicotine emissions and what might we suggest. And in this conversation, I will set aside for the moment any concerns I might have about long-term e-cigarette risk to health, either individual or public health, and talk simply about the possibility for a nicotine sweet spot. That is, it's possible that electronic cigarettes as a class could emit nicotine fast enough and at doses high enough to suppress withdrawal completely in a tobacco cigarette smoker and completely substitute for tobacco cigarettes after the first two or three puffs that a tobacco cigarette smoker takes from the electronic cigarette. And at the same time, in this concept of the sweet spot, low enough nicotine emissions to avoid the abuse or use of nicotine and electronic cigarettes in non-smokers, especially youth. And I think most of us would agree that we don't want to see the next generation addicted to electronic cigarettes and nicotine. We suggest that in order to find this sweet spot and inform regulation around it, we avoid the concept of nicotine yield, but instead turn to nicotine flux, where nicotine flux is yield per unit time. So it takes into account how much nicotine is coming out per time unit, and we suggest microgram per second in a paper we published on this issue. The great things about nicotine flux are that it accounts for variation in use time across products, so it recognizes that 1 milligram of nicotine in 5 minutes produces dramatically different effects in an individual than 1 milligram over 5 hours. And it also represents the maximum rate of nicotine delivery to the blood system, since nicotine can't get into the blood any faster than it can get into the mouth, and nicotine flux describes how fast it gets into the mouth. I've already described for you the things that would help predict nicotine flux, and we've broken them into two categories: design efficacy, things that have to do with the design of the product, and that's the cartomizer, the basic design, the heating element, the liquid, the things we went over before, and puff intensity, user behavior. And it turns out you can plot these two parameters, design efficacy and puff intensity, on a contour plot where, in this case, the bluish colors correspond to a device that's largely ineffective at delivering nicotine, either because of its design or because of the puff intensity or the interaction between the two. The reddish colors would be a device that brings us into the unsafe realm of nicotine flux, either because the abuse liability is so high or even because the toxicity is so great that you would want to avoid it. And then the target area, that sweet spot I described, is in the greenish-blue areas. So here is that contour plot, again, design efficacy over puffing intensity. And here are some example products and where they fall on that contour plot. So let's look at product A, which has a design efficacy which, with respect to nicotine delivery, is so poor that across a huge range of puff intensities, it's always in that ineffective blue range. I would suggest to you this is exactly the type of products that I tested and reported on in 2010 that were unable to deliver any nicotine in the conditions under which I tested them. Product B, on the other hand, is one that has a design efficacy that, over some puffing behaviors, moves us into the red area. I would suggest that this is a high-voltage device loaded with a high milligram per milliliter concentration nicotine liquid, and that device such as this might have abuse liability so great that perhaps it shouldn't be on the market. Product C is the same as product B, but it has some additional electronics put into it such that the puffing behavior is controlled by the device rather than the user. So it might limit the puff duration, which we've seen influences nicotine yield and flux. It might limit the puff duration to 2 seconds instead of allowing 4 or 8 second puffs, and then also control the inner puff interval, which would allow the heater some time to cool down between puffs. I'm not saying these are the only things you might want to do to control product B to bring it more like product C, but those are certainly two things that could be done to reach that goal. I'm not saying also that we know everything we need to know about nicotine flux. There's a lot more we need to do. We want to relate nicotine flux to nicotine delivery to the user, that is plasma nicotine concentration, and then understand how nicotine flux relates to user effects, specifically withdrawal suppression and substitution for tobacco cigarettes. And most importantly, for some of the talks we had heard earlier, explore the fluxes of other toxicants, because of course it's not only nicotine we're interested in, and how does increasing nicotine flux influence something like formaldehyde flux. So in conclusion, e-cigarettes are an evolving set of devices that vary considerably across engineering and operating characteristics. When these characteristics interact with user behavior, together they influence the amount of nicotine emitted from the mouth end of an e-cigarette. The influence of device and behavior on nicotine yield can be measured, and very importantly, it can be predicted. And learning about e-cigarettes and crafting a science-based regulation for them will require a programmatic approach that involves understanding device characteristics, user behavior, and the interaction between the two. And with that, I'll thank you.
Okay, Dr. Rob Stevens from Lorillard Tobacco Company will be speaking on CRESTA, Electronic Cigarette Task Force.
Alrighty, first of all, on behalf of CRESTA, we'd like to thank the organizing committee for allowing us to come and speak on behalf of some of our studies that we've completed recently on the CRESTA e-cigarette task force looking at e-liquids and e-cigarette aerosols. While I am the Director of Testing Services at Lorillard Tobacco Company, I'm today here speaking on behalf of CRESTA. With CRESTA, I'm the Secretary of the Smoke Science Study Group for the CRESTA Scientific Commission, and I'm the Secretary for the CRESTA e-cigarette task force. First of all, a little bit about CRESTA. CRESTA is the Cooperation Center for Scientific Research Relative to Tobacco. It's an independent association, and its purpose is to encourage international cooperation to actively work on tobacco-related areas of research. One of the big advantages of CRESTA is the diversity of the members of CRESTA. There are members from all around the world that provide their expertise and their experiences that allow us to do very scientific studies to advance the science in topics such as e-cigarettes. For the e-cigarette task force, we have members that represent consumer products, e-cigarette manufacturers, e-liquid manufacturers, academia, regulators, testing laboratories, as well as companies that develop equipment and also different components. So a very diverse group within the task force. The task force was created in 2013. The coordinator of the task force is Dr. Charles Gardner, and I am the secretary. Our membership continues to expand as we learn new things. At our recent meeting in Quebec City, we had over 50 people in attendance, and our membership now has gotten close to 70 people within the task force, and over 45 different organizations are participating, which allows us a lot of opportunity to test methods across different platforms. The objectives of the task force are shown on this slide. The first objective was to create a document on worldwide product definition and definitions of terms to support harmonization of nomenclature. This particular objective was completed earlier this year when a paper was published on the CRESTA website that detailed the history of e-cigarettes as well as detailed at that point in time different regulatory standards from around the world and also provided definitions for the terms for e-cigarettes. So you can go to the CRESTA website to see this document. This completed this particular objective because the task force concluded that with things changing so frequently that we would go back later and potentially look at something else, but at this time that document is the source. For this particular workshop, I'm going to be focusing on the objective number two, to gather and share preliminary data on analyses relevant to e-cigarettes worldwide with a view to making recommendations for product testing. I'm going to be sharing with you today two extensive proficiency studies, one on e-liquids and one on e-cigarette aerosols. In the e-cigarette aerosol proficiency study, I'll also talk about puffing parameters. As with the questions that were provided by the FDA for this workshop, I will be talking about ingredients as well as methods, selections of puffing parameters across the different laboratories. The e-liquid study was a study in which 9 different laboratories from around the world tested the same 11 samples. We also included in this study a study control, which is very important in comparing methods across laboratories. The samples that we tested varied in different amounts for the nicotine, glycerin, propylene glycol, and the water. Nicotine ranged from 0 to 1.6%, glycerin and propylene glycol between 0 and 100%, and water between 0 and 10%. The methodology used across the 9 laboratories was actually very similar. The sample preparation involved weighing the samples, diluting the samples, shaking the samples, and then injecting the samples using gas chromatographic techniques. All labs utilized the GC-FID, the flame ionization detection, for the analysis of nicotine, glycerin, and PG. Some labs utilized the Carl Fisher technique for the analysis of water, and other labs utilized the GC-TCD. Other differences that existed based upon things such as the shake time and the amount of solvent used did vary between labs as well as the columns used for the GCs. Now let's look at some data. As I mentioned earlier, we used a study control. The study control was a sample that was distributed to each laboratory that had an exact amount of nicotine, glycerin, PG, and water within it. This sample was analyzed by each of the laboratories, and the precision was excellent. Nicotine across the labs here shown in this slide, you can see that it ranged between 0.2 to 4.5%. So all the laboratories had less than 5% error when comparing their lab results to the target amounts. Also for glycerin and PG, the results were really good. They were below 10% across the laboratories, most around 5% error. And in water was a little bit more variability, and this can be shown in the next slide of why that might have occurred. This graph shows the different laboratories and the methods they used for the analysis of water. The first four laboratories used the Carl Fisher technique, and what you can see in this graph is that the blue bars represent the target amount for each of the samples distributed to that laboratory. The purple bar represents the Carl Fisher analyses, which had an average percent error of approximately 3%. The error for the GC-TCD method had an average error of approximately 13%. Across the board, all of these analyses were really well done, and even having an error for water of less than 15% is really, really good. Now I'd like to look at the results from the commercial samples. We had 10 different commercial samples, and shown here are the results for the average of all the laboratories and the standard deviations, and then also the nominal amounts for each of the samples. And what you can see is we actually had to report the results to two decimal places to be able to see some of the differences between the actual lab results compared to the nominal amounts for the e-liquids. So the results were extremely good. Now, in summary for the e-liquid study, the analytical methods used by the 9 different labs were very similar as far as their procedures and the mode of analysis. The analysis of water was a little bit different between some of the laboratories, but the results showed high accuracy and precision. Now I'd like to shift gears and talk about the e-cigarette aerosol studies. The purpose of this study was to determine consistency of results between labs using the same puffing regime and comparing methods across the laboratories. We did an initial study where we looked at different puffing parameters to determine what our recommended method would be for the proficiency study. When we did the proficiency study, 14 labs participated and 8 different samples were used, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. First of all, the methods used for e-cigarette aerosol studies were very similar again across the laboratories. Standard methods for collecting the aerosol were performed using conventional smoking machines that were in the laboratories. The aerosol was collected on a Cambridge filter pads. Various solvents were used to extract the samples, and then the samples were injected on GC-FIDs for the analysis of nicotine, glycerin, and water, and propylene glycol, and GC-TCD for the analysis of water. There were some differences between labs. Both linear and rotary smoking machines were used, and the conditions were not held constant across all the laboratories. A lot of labs did use ISO conditions, but some did not. Also within the sample preparation, the shake time for the samples did vary, and the internal standards varied, as well as the number of calibration standards that were used. This slide depicts the impact of puffing parameters on the total yield. What is seen here is the total aerosol collected matter. This is what's collected on the Cambridge filter pad for 4 different smoking regimes. The first bar represents the 55 milliliter puff volume, 3 second puff duration, a square wave, and a 30 second puff interval. The second bar is a 4 second duration at the 55 milliliter puff volume. The third one is a 7 milliliter puff volume with a 3 second puff duration. And the fourth one is a 70 milliliter puff volume and a 4 second duration. What you can see here is for three different disposable products analyzed at three different laboratories, there was no difference in that total aerosol collected matter yield depending upon which regime was used. Also, the precision was very similar among all the different test sets that were tested in this study. Here are the results for the total PG, total nicotine, total glycerin, and total water that were run across all of the different puffing regimes for all four laboratories and the rechargeable and disposable products. And what you can see is that the range is not very wide for each of these constituents, and the percent composition was not affected by varying the regime for the total yield across those regimes. Therefore, the recommendation was made by the task force for the e-cigarette aerosol study was to use a 55 milliliter puff volume, a 3 second puff duration, a 30 second puff interval, and a square wave profile. This worked very well for the existing smoking machines that were in the laboratories around the world, and it also was relevant for all the products that were tested. 14 labs tested the same 8 samples. We had 4 disposable products, and we had 4 rechargeable products, and they were all tested at 14 different laboratories. Total yield, nicotine, glycerin, propylene glycol, and water were all collected. These results were just generated back in the summer of this year, so I'm only going to be able to show you just a couple of slides for these results, but a technical report will be out at the beginning of January, beginning of 2015, on all of these studies. This slide depicts the propylene glycol reported as a percent of aerosol collected for all 8 of the products that were tested for all 14 of the different laboratories. The dotted lines represent the divider between the different products. So what you can see is, for the first product, there was no propylene glycol, which was not observed by any of the labs. No labs detected it except for one that had a little bit of contamination. But what you can also see from this graph is that you start to see some of the within-laboratory variability because each lab did 5 replicates of an analysis. And also you can start to see some of the between lab variability. So for some of the products, the percent total collected aerosol matter did vary, and also the PG concentrations then did vary. This graph depicts 2 ways to represent the data. For this aerosol study, we did collect in 50 puff segments. Very important that when you collect the aerosol, you want to do it in puff sets. So on the left-hand side, you can see how we plotted the cumulative amounts of the aerosol collected matter as a total amount. It levels off right around the 8th pad, which is at the lifetime, at the end of the lifetime of the particular product that was tested. On the right-hand side, you can see each individual puff set plotted for the aerosol collected matter. And once again, you can see the drop-off at the very end, which indicates when the end of the lifetime of the product. The difference between the laboratories was approximately 20 to 25 milligrams, which again is really good when you're comparing across 14 different laboratories. This last data slide illustrates a way from a product quality standpoint to be able to see if you've got good results from a study standpoint covering the device as well as the aerosol collected procedure. What we have here is plotted the e-cigarette mass loss as a ratio of the aerosol collected matter. And this is plotted as a function of the aerosol collected matter. So what you can see is if you collect less than 40 milligrams on your total pad for the aerosol collected matter, your variation starts to increase significantly. However, when you have greater than 40 milligrams, the consistency was very good across the laboratories. This is data from every lab that tested. Therefore, in conclusion, for the aerosol study, methods were very similar across all the 14 laboratories that performed the studies, And the results were very consistent for nicotine, glycerin, PG, and water. And also this e-cigarette mass loss compared to the aerosol collected matter is a very good metric to measure and verify results. The CRESTA e-cigarette task force has had significant accomplishments in the first 2 years that it's existed, since 2013. We have technical reports that will be published on the CRESTA website for the proficiency study of e-liquids for 9 different laboratories. The puffing parameter study was completed, and the proficiency study was just completed this summer. Statistical analysis is still occurring, and the results will be reported in January. In conclusion, the value of CRESTA is as follows. The global interdisciplinary expertise provides a great opportunity to share and advance knowledge and the experience that CRESTA has and the resources that CRESTA has to develop methods and to lead interlab studies is a great tool to be able to develop and recommend analytical methods. Thank you for your time and your attention.
Okay, and our next speaker is Dr. Michael Hufford from eNicotine Technology, speaking on understanding electronic nicotine delivery systems through the lens of pharmaceutical respiratory drug delivery. Because I did have a clarifying question for one of Dr. Trahey. This was for you. Are nicotine and non-nicotine containing solutions being tested on the same equipment you looked at? Because whether the testing of nicotine containing liquids on same equipment as non-nicotine containing nicotine distorts outcomes of nicotine levels presence. So are you making sure there's not contamination between the two?
Well, the simple answer is yes, we're using the same equipment, but we also check for carryover with running blanks and things. Those samples, you know, if you had shown, you know, when you have go from 0 to 20 mgs for a sample, that's not carryover. That's clearly mislabeled product. You know, there's a lot of reasons that can happen in manufacturing, but, you know, clearly they have there's an issue with those samples.
Thank you. Dr. Flora, why didn't you test for the stability of carrier contents, propylene glycol, glycerin in your study? So why didn't you test for the stability of carrier contents of the propylene glycol or glycerin in your study?
So we do extensive testing of all of our products. So this study, the purpose of what I was reporting today was just related to nicotine impurity. So we do test other things than just nicotine impurities in our product.
It's not the intent of the talk.
Correct. And there were strict limitations on the time, too. So for Monique Williams, what levels of detected metals were found in the sample air before it passed through the device? So what levels of detected metals were found in the sample air before it went through the device?
The concentration of the metals in the actual room air that we did test were much lower than what was detected in e-cigarettes. Hope that answers the question.
Okay, so it sounds like negligible.
It wasn't negligible, but it was just much lower than, because there are elements and metals in the air.
Okay, good. Thank you. We're ready to go. Okay, Dr. Hufford.
It's a real pleasure to be here with you all. As the last speaker between you and lunch, I understand there's a lot of both pressure and perhaps power in that, I guess. In terms of my disclosure, I'm a full-time employee, co-founder of eNicotine Technology, which is a healthcare company committed to reducing the harms associated with combustible tobacco products. We're an angel investor-backed company, all funded by healthcare angel investors. My own background is I spent 14 years after being a nicotine researcher, doing drug development. And so I was very fortunate to work on a number of products that have received FDA approval through CDER. And my colleagues and I founded eNicotine Technology to kind of leverage some of that expertise and apply it to this field of emerging electronic nicotine delivery devices. Like any good pharmaceutical industry scientist, I've also worked on my fair share of drugs that did not make it through that process. And so my goal today is to really compare and contrast these two classes of products, one of which the FDA is obviously very familiar with in terms of the right-hand side. So these are the MDIs, DPIs, and other sorts of respiratory drug delivery products, those on the left being the ones we're considering here today. They differ in a lot of ways, and at the highest level, fundamentally, some of these products are enjoyable, and some are not. They're intentionally also not meant to be. But I actually think, in all seriousness, this gives some people pause. I think there's greater concern because some of these products are enjoyable, but really that's also key and foundational to their public health utility, that they are compelling enough that smokers will transition off of combustible products to use them. So that enjoyment is actually something to be carefully considered, calibrated, and perhaps manipulated moving forward, and we'll talk more about that. Obviously, the ENDDs are unregulated today, and really what that fundamentally means, I think, from a regulatory science perspective, are that these products have very little data on their purity, consistency of emitted dose. Whereas any of you who have worked on a new drug application can attest, approved products have just a staggering amount of data on these and many other things. So as the FDA now moves to exert its regulatory authority over both these different classes of products, it really poses a unique dilemma, because the agency is very, very good with dealing with nails, and now they are faced with a screw, if you will. And of course, they have a lot of different tools that they can bring to bear. And certainly through CDER, this is a schematic of a typical drug development pathway for a new chemical entity. And this process, frankly, works very, very well to ensure that a new chemical introduced to the body, whether orally or intravenously or through the respiratory tract, is safe and effective. That being said, I would also argue that nicotine is, you know, one of the most inhaled substances on the planet. It's only a slight exaggeration to say it would rank order only probably behind oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon monoxide, which is the main drug that a combustible cigarette produces. So we also know a lot about nicotine. But let's talk about ways in which approved respiratory drug delivery devices and electronic nicotine delivery devices are the same, because they're actually very much alike in a number of critical ways. One, the destination is the same. I don't seem to have a mouse pointer, but you can see there's a 2-micron aerosol particle, right here. And so the target for all these products are the lung epithelium, although certainly with ENDDs, a lot of the vapor and condensation aerosol is deposited in the mouth and the back of the throat. But regardless, just to give you a sense, if you calculate the volume here, a typical inhalation from an electronic cigarette will produce hundreds of millions to billions of particles in the submicron range. So lots of this is being produced, and the destination then is the same. The fundamental disposition of particles is the same. Some end up in the oral cavity, will be absorbed through the GI tract and eliminated through the liver. Other will enter the lungs, where it has both a local and systemic effect. So the fundamental disposition of the particles is the same. And certainly the physics governing condensation aerosols are the same. The physics doesn't care whether or not, frankly, the condensation aerosol is being emitted from a regulated product or an unregulated one. The particle size is determined by the physics. This is a wonderful paper by Rabinowitz et al. That kind of talk about those physics. But again, this kind of speaks to some of the science is the same and very well established around how these particles will grow, and indeed, not just where they'll grow, but where they will deposit in the airway. So this is a wonderful paper, if you've not read it, by Patton and Byron. It came out in Nature Review Drug Discovery, talking about the critical importance, and it was mentioned several times earlier today, about particle size and where those particles will deposit. And if your goal is to create a likable product that's compelling enough to drive smokers from their combustible product use, not just to experiment with, but to substitute with an electronic nicotine delivery product, you likely need to closely mimic the pharmacokinetics. Well, this is a blow-up, and again, this exact, so the x-axis here is a distribution of particle size in microns. The y-axis is the percent alveoli deposition, and the point I want to make here is there's something of a Goldilocks principle at work here. Particles that are too small here in the blue area, submicron particles, are small enough to reach the deep lung, but too light to gravitationally settle there and will be exhaled. And in fact, when you see vapors vaping and you see huge plumes of vapor, and you know, some people refer to it as Olympic vaping, just seeing how much of that they can put out, you know, fundamentally none of that is being deposited. If you're exhaling it, it did not get absorbed in your lung. And in fact, when you look, and certainly in our lab as well, when we use either Anderson cascade impactors or laser particle size detectors, typically the average particle size is right around half a micron. Particles in the green area are large enough to reach the deep lung, small enough to navigate their way to the deep lung, but large enough to have gravitational mass to settle there. That results typically in more rapid PK, as we'll get into. Particles in the pink area are too large. They impact in the mouth or upper airway. And one point I want to make here is that so if we think of e-cigs today are right here, I'm not sure it's what Adam Smith meant in The Wealth of Nations about the invisible hand of the market, but certainly in our lab when we test some of the tank systems that are becoming more popular, the particle size from some of those tank systems are much closer to 1 micron. And so I'm not sure that that was an intentional manipulation of the physics to generate a larger particle, but it is the case that the longer these products are in the market and as folks experiment with them and develop, you see that particle size changing, which may be resulting in a higher PK. And indeed, there was some data presented recently at Jed Rose's Duke Nicotine Conference suggesting just that, that some of those tank systems are now delivering much more nicotine much more rapidly than the first generation product. This is another figure just showing that if you get the particle size right, so that if you generate a 1 to 5 micron particle, oftentimes the PK is indistinguishable from an IV bolus. And that's true for nicotine as well. This has been shown both non-clinically as well as clinically. You can get very smoking-like PK using different carriers. These are both academic or industry publications, just showing that it's possible. And you've seen this graph earlier today from Farsalinos, who's here in the audience, showing that while the second-generation devices are delivering more nicotine, they are in no way beginning to approximate the change in nicotine that a smoker experiences when they smoke. And we know that that slope, that rate of rise of nicotine is directly related to its reinforcing tendency because of activation of the alpha-4 beta-2 receptor. So clearly more work to do here and more innovation is needed. And I'd also note that just recently Jonathan Fools published a paper in Nicotine Tobacco Research looking at nicotine dependency among electronic cigarette users and arguing that in fact we might need a subset of products that is far more capable of more rapidly delivering nicotine so that we don't get experimentation with these devices. We get true transition of nicotine consumption from deadly combustible products to these products. So we have these two classes of products, and I would argue that it's important to change the way we look at electronic nicotine delivery devices using what we can from existing regulatory science, but also considering ways in which they're different and unique. And I'm going to turn to that now and talk about that in a couple of different ways, one being the intended uses as well as the labeling and the container closure system, to use regulatory speak. Intended uses and relative risk, this is central to regulation. In fact, there's an entire guidance document just on intended uses of your various devices. Fundamentally, and the elephant in the room, is that fundamentally electronic nicotine delivery devices are intended to provide an alternative to smoking. And I would argue that any presentation of data talking about toxicants and what have you, which is critically important, there's been some wonderful presentations, it's critical to have a column in those charts that compare it, as many of them did, to the exposures presented from combustible tobacco products. Fundamentally, these products are used to titrate to effect, which is oftentimes unique to the user. The other thing I just wanted to touch on is labeling. These are two classes of products, the soon-to-be regulated product, the ENDDs there on the left, regulated products on the right. It's just a goes to show that regulation doesn't solve everything. So these are both, so this is the regulated product, cigarettes. This is the warning that users have on that. I have to point out, because the irony is so delicious, that the same manufacturer that puts this warning on cigarettes puts 10 times as many words, 117 words, on their warning for the electronic nicotine delivery device. Also, just give you a sense, if you haven't done so, I would encourage you, if you're well caffeinated, to download the FDA-approved package insert for Advair. This is a 61-page document, including 10 pages of instructions for use. So it just goes to show you can also go overboard and have probably much more information than is helpful, at least to the user. Admittedly, a package insert serves many important legal and regulatory purposes, but I do challenge any of you to get through it. It really should have its own black box warning about drowsiness, because it is hard to get through 61 pages of a package insert. So just to kind of walk through the container closure system, again, there's a lot of certainty and comfort with the regulated product because the drug substance and excipients are all known. Their purity and physical and chemical stability is very well established. The container closure system that it's then put into, again, extraordinarily well known, known leachables and extractables, a known particle size. I was frankly really shocked to hear about, you know, solder being in the airway of existing ENDDs. That doesn't happen in respiratory drug delivery devices, right? Because it's a bad idea. And so we can learn from some of that. And the result of all that is the emitted dose of these, one, tends to be fixed. And in fact, at least according to the MDI guidance, 5% change from target is in fact a significant deviation. Now that may simply not be appropriate. I would argue that, again, that to have a compelling product, you may not want a fixed dose. It may be important to have a variable dose, but this is how it's approached, at least on the CDER side. For ENDDs, hopefully where I hope we get to with the help of the deeming regs, where the drug substance and excipients could be subject to GMP manufacturing, where we have some sense of what's in it. There may be approved materials and processes that allow for a variety of aerosol generation processes. The resultant particle size may vary, and that may be okay. It's critically important to note that, by the way, the emitted dose, the nicotine emitted dose, is not the same as the deposited dose. So just because a lot of nicotine is emitted does not, in fact, at all mean that that's being deposited. In any event, the resultant particle size may vary. And so as a result, you may have a variable dose, but it could always be in a specified range with known purity and degradants. And I think it'd be a great day when we get there. Folks have talked about variability. The heating element's been well established. I won't dwell on that. The timing of aerosolization hasn't been talked about. I'll just note, so this is a device that we've developed, and this is a breath-actuated discrete heating with no visibly expired vapor. There's a lot going on here. Blue is aerosol present, red is the inhalation rate, green is the exhalation and coil voltage. So here, upon breath, there's a discrete period of vaporization to create the condensation aerosol. It then stops, so you have chase air to get that help get it down into the deep lung with particle size control. It's then exhaled with very little, functionally no visible vapor. A more traditional device generates vapor the entire time over the course of the breath, and then, of course, a lot of it comes back out. Also talked about the liquid, and I appreciate that variability can be a source of a lot of angst. I just wanted to point out with variability also comes opportunity, an opportunity to engineer things so that they are safer. And, in fact, this is just one example. It's possible to use GMP materials, medical-grade stainless steel, and actually generate much less formaldehyde and other thermal decomposition products, depending on how the devices are engineered. I won't talk about device resistance and user behavior. Some of that's already been touched on. What does the future hold then? This is a wonderful quote from Nick Bostrom in his book, Superintelligence, where he says, think of a discovery as an act that moves the arrival of information from a later point in time to an earlier time. The discovery's value does not equal the value of information discovered, but rather the value of having the information available earlier than it otherwise would have been. And if you think about, had ENDDs been invented 50 years ago, properly regulated and on the market today, I would argue untold lives could have been saved. And it is now both a burden but also an obligation for both manufacturers as well as regulators to be sure that these devices, I think, can be an incredibly important tool and perhaps the most powerful tool in our toolbox to bend this projected curve of tobacco-related deaths, not just downward but eventually towards zero. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for clarifying questions for the particularly last speakers, but any of the questions, if you want to bring them forward, thank you, because basically what we're going to do is I'm going to collect the questions that we'd like the panel to address, and we'll be doing that right after lunch. But any clarifying questions? So I'm going to open one thing. Dr. Eisenberg, does the high abuse liability end of nicotine flux model cover the alternative behaviors? For example, when users are not sufficiently satisfied with the nicotine craving. So does the high abuse liability end of nicotine flux model cover the alternative behaviors of when they're not sufficiently satisfied with their nicotine cravings?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I can say what the nicotine flux model is trying to do. It's trying to suggest that there is a level of nicotine flux that would lead users to not do the alternative behaviors that I think are being referred to in the question, because they would be satisfied. And there's also a point of nicotine flux where a user, a tobacco cigarette smoker would be satisfied, it would be such high abuse liability that a non-tobacco smoker would also be satisfied and, in fact, pleasured by the device. And what we want to do is get to the level of nicotine flux that satisfies the tobacco cigarette smoker but doesn't pleasure the non-user.
Okay, and I have several other for you, but this one I'm going to put in a clarifying question. What are the types of traditional cigarettes that you tested? Filtered, non-filtered, others? So you had the traditional cigarette up there? Yes, sir. You, Tom. Yep. Sorry, Dr. Eisenberg. Yes.
Sorry, we didn't test those. Those were, and if you look at the Talia paper in Preston, you'll see a reference for it. But that was a range for a wide variety of different combustible cigarettes. So it wasn't any single cigarette.
Okay. Thank you. The other questions I am going to save for the panel. Any other clarifying questions that came up? Okay, so we break now until 1:30 for lunch. We'll have the panelists. The panelists, you know who you are. Please be here a few minutes early so we can get that set up, and we'll start on time. Don't leave your stuff in the room. We're not going to watch it for you. Hopefully everybody's in here, you know, won't take it from you, but we're not watching it for you, so take it if you want it back.